Hey, hey, welcome to the Friday Night Life podcast. We're your hosts, Chris and Kareen Stevens. Now, babe, hit that pregame music button.
Welcome to the Friday Night Life podcast with your hosts and veteran high school football coaching couple, Chris and Kareen Stevens. Whether you're in your first year or 50th year of coaching, you are in for a positive and uplifting experience. It's time to huddle up and get an all-access pass to the lives of coaches, their spouses, and their crazy Friday night lives. And now let's kick it off with your hosts, Chris and Kareen Stevens.
Thanks again for coming back to the Friday Night Life podcast. If this is your first time with us, welcome. We know you're in for an exciting adventure. Whether you are a coach, a coach's spouse, or just a huge fan of all things football, we know you will come away inspired and encouraged. Don't forget to visit our website at www.thefridaynightlife.com. Sign up to be a part of our booster club and receive emails of upcoming episodes and other great stuff regarding our podcast. Also, check out our Spirit Pack shop and get your FNL merchandise. Calling all coaches, shoot us an email and let us know if you would like to be a part of our podcast. You can find us on social media, Twitter at the FNL Podcast, IG at the Friday Night Life, and Facebook and YouTube, the Friday Night Life.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Friday Night Life podcast. I've got a real special guest here today, very near and dear friend of mine. Consider him, we call ourselves brothers from another mother. This is Les Robinson. He is the current head football coach at the Trinity Classical Academy up in Santa Clarita. He is also the Santa Clarita Valley Fellowship of Christian Athletes Regional Director. And Les, I thank you for coming on, man. It is so great to see you and chat it up with you today.
Coach Stevens, thank you so much for inviting me out. It's going to be wonderful to be your guest today. I'm honored.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you, Les. And just a quick tidbit right off the cuff, and this is great, is that we are connected. We're almost family because you're coaching my nephew right now who's in your program. So a lot of people that didn't know that, my nephews are going up there and being a part of your school. I couldn't be happier to have my family under your leadership and tutelage in there. So appreciate that, man.
Well, your nephew, Aiden Doom, is a fine player, and I think I saw an article a couple of weeks ago, and he's ranked in the top six defensive ends in the state.
Man.
He had a phenomenal season last year, 15 sacks and 110 tackles and a couple fumble touchdown recoveries. He's an awesome athlete. We look for great things out of him.
And he gets none of that from his uncle, let me tell you that right now.
great attitude. He has a great engine.
Yeah, oh man. Well, and thank you for all that you do for him and for the boys up there, and being a football coach and also the Fellowship of Christian Athletes director. I mean, you're burning at both ends, man. It's a great ministry, not only to be in that position of head coach. That's a platform in itself. But man, unless you go above and beyond ministering to all schools up in that area. And so just real briefly, just kind of let us, tell us a little bit about how you got into Fellowship of Christian Athletes.
I ran in a fellowship at Christian Athletes when I was about 15 years old. I thought I was going to a football camp. I was the projected as the new starting tailback at Sacramento High School back in the summer of 73. And for the 74 season, so our coach would send four or five athletes to this camp. A little did I know it was a Christian camp. And the camp was in Ashland, Oregon. And at that time, I lived in Sacramento. So we took the bus overnight. And first time I seen snow going through the pass. And we got to Southern Oregon College. And little did I know, when I got off the bus, they gave me a packet. And in the packet, there was a Bible. Well, I knew what that was about. And I was like, oh, my God. It's a Christian camp, because I grew up in church, but and knew about God, but didn't know God. And it was at FCA camp, that camp in 1973, that I heard the great ex-head football coach of the Dallas Cowboys, Coach Tom Landry, give an invitation give his testimony, invitation, and I received Christ in 1973 at FCA camp because of Coach Tom Landry.
Outstanding. Outstanding. And then in 73, and then from there, giving your heart to Christ, probably little did you know, that you would be in this position that you were today, you know, so many years ago. But I'm sure that played a huge impact on your young life and then coming up through as you were playing football. I mean, you're listed to one of the greats, right, of all time, arguably one of the great coaches of all time, one of the legends in our game. And, boy, that must have had a true impact on you as a player and now as a coach as well, right?
It did. And as I went through my high school and college career, I met some coaches that I met. I ran into coaches that I met at that camp. And it's funny, I never had anything else to do with – I went to camp the next year in the 74 summer, and I never heard of FCA again after that until about 16, 17 years ago here in Southern California. And because at that point, when I gave my life to Christ, they weren't meeting on campuses. They would just have the camps. There were no huddles. The huddles would happen at camp, and they would garner a couple hundreds of kids to go to camp, and then there was nothing going on weekly. But when I became familiar with FCA again, some 40-odd years later, 30 or 40-some-odd years later, they had evolved to what they are now. And then I was pastoring a church at that time. My pastor was a senior pastor of the Burning Bush Church. I founded a church on my couch, and we grew to a little over 500. Mm-hmm. And we lost our building in an owner-city dispute. Mm-hmm. And we had to let our church go. It was a very sad time for me because we were very successful. We were having a great time. Many people were being healed, delivered, and set free. A lot of lives were being changed. We're having great impact in the city. And I remember when it happened, I was so confused and so hurt. I remember this one particular morning, I refused to come out of my room. I prayed for probably over 3 hours just by myself. And I said, God, I'm not leaving this room until you tell me what this is about and what my next step is. And I just got quiet before him for about a half hour. And all of a sudden, I heard in a still small voice, he said, FCA. And I felt like somebody hit me with a right cross. I'm like, because I hadn't thought about FCA in decades. Never even crossed my mind. The very organization that caused me to give my life to Christ would come full circle in my life. I got up from prayer and I went to my computer and I put FCA in the computer and it took me to the site for LA. And I wrote, I can almost remember what I wrote. I said, hey, my name is Les Robinson. I'm the pastor of the Burning Bush Church in Santa Clarita. How can I help? And a half hour later, I got a call from the then Southern California director by the name of Mark Ratcher. And about a half hour later, he said, can I come up there and have a cup of coffee with you? Can we sit down for coffee? And it started from there.
Wow, yeah. That's great. And so at that time, you were pastoring this church when that whole thing went, did you have to have any conversations with the leadership of that church? I mean, I know you were kind of co-founding it, but was it tough to kind of break away, or was that when that whole thing went down, was it easier for you and you felt like that was the transition time? Like this is now this is what I'm going to do.
Oh, it was easy. It was not only now is what I'm going to do, it's all I had left to do. I was also an assistant coach at Saugus High School. So, you know, it was just like I said, it felt like I got hit with a right cross. It's like, you dummy. Don't you know you should have been doing ministry with sport all along? That's who you are. It's what you do. It's what you've been doing your whole life. You've been in sport. You've been in the Word. Why haven't you seen this before? It was like, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It was like a
well, you're like me, Les. We need that hammer on the head sometimes, you know?
Yeah. But it was difficult. It was very difficult. It was very
– Yeah.
I had put so much into the church, and we were very successful. I mean, we were having great impact. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to let that go and stop. But I was trying to hang on to it, but at the same time, I could see where God was leading. So mm-hmm. it was hard, but it was easy.
Isn't that awesome the way God leads? And from that still small voice now, Les, you are in charge of the Santa Clarita Valley and the high schools that you minister to, Canyon High School, Golden Valley, Hart High School, Legacy Christian, Saugus, as you mentioned, Trinity Classical, your school, Valencia High School, West Ranch, and College of the Canyons. You've got a huddle up there at College of the Canyons, which is wonderful. So
their football team.
Yeah, yeah, that's outstanding. And all those schools now and all those kids being impacted by FCA. And it wasn't too long ago that Saugus High School had gone through a pretty traumatic experience, right? They had an on-campus shooting. And so take us through that a little bit, Les, as you were kind of overseeing that school and Fellowship of Christian Athletes huddle going on there. Just kind of take us back to that moment and tell us when you heard that news, how you responded, and then going forward, how you ministered to those kids and those coaches.
I remember very clearly it was a Thursday morning. We were just finishing our Uncommon Men's Prayer Group. It is a prayer group that is sponsored by FCA. Mm-hmm. And Coach, someone saw something or heard something. I called Coach Bourne, or he called me and said, hey, we're under siege. There's a shooter on campus. And we began to pray. And then at that point, we began to plan a healing service for Saugus High School. That was my first huddle. That's where we started our first huddle in the Santa Clarita Valley. We have nine now. That was our first one, and I started it. And that was the only huddle out there for 3.5 years. And so the Saugus huddle and Saugus campus is dear to my heart. It's my public school. I mean, I'm at Trinity, but Coach Bourne, Jason Bourne, has always been my friend. He's always been one of my confidants. We've always loved each other and tried to help each other. And he actually runs that huddle now. He's doing a fine job with that campus, and he's very instrumental in our football program at FCA camp at UCLA every summer. He runs the defense. Yeah. And God has really blessed him and his wife and that campus through Jason Bourne. Mm. And so when I heard this news, it really hurt me. And I really wanted to do something for them. But we had planned a healing service, hope and healing service, and we weren't able to pull it off because of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. So Saugus High School has suffered some major tragedies this last school year. I really feel bad for them, but God got us through it, and you know, mm-hmm. we went over and ministered to them several times during their weekly huddles. But I really feel for that, especially their senior class.
Some great individuals,
some great students, and some great people. And I pray that God would heal some of those memories and some of those moments. And I know everything happens for a purpose, and I trust that God will. I know that something great is going to come of this, you know.
Sure.
But yes, it was quite a time, quite a test of love and grace for all of us in that area. But God's in control.
I believe.
There's some good things I think that have happened because of COVID-19.
Yes, sir.
Not all bad. I think this has been a great time for people who think, and we've all had to think, to take breaks, to really re-examine our lives, re-examine our values, re-examine who we are, what we want to be, and what we want to do. We've had the time to see things such as, racial reconciliation. I believe that the events that happened in the past few months would not have been noticed or dealt with or addressed the way they have been so far if COVID-19 hadn't happened. I think because of COVID-19, the world was pretty still. We were forced to be still. It's like God said, we need a timeout.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he stopped sports. He stopped business. He stopped school. He stopped even government. Mm. And we all had to pay attention to some things that have been important for a long time that we have been either too busy or too apathetic to see. So
yes,
I think that if we approach this thing right, a lot of good can come from this challenge that the world's going through.
Yes, sir. No, absolutely. Appreciate that. And we're going to talk a little bit more too about your legacy and some things that you found out recently about your family that we'll touch on too, about the situation of our country and the states and some of the the things that have been awoken in a lot of people, especially a very interesting thing that was awoken in your life and your background. And we'll talk about your great-great-grandfather here in just a little bit. This goes back to you now, Les. Let's talk about your up and coming. You grew up Northern California. Like I said, we're going to get to your great-great-grandfather here in just a minute, but let's talk about life of Les Robinson now. When you were coming up, how did you start playing football? Who was your role models? Who impacted you to play the game and to carry that with you into coaching? And then I know we have some different careers maybe that Lord could have moved you and sent you down, but he brought you back to coaching. So let's just do a little timeline of Les and take us through your journey.
Well, I'm the oldest of six children. I'm actually the third. And I grew up in a strict Pentecostal family, old school Pentecostal. My brother and I, Don, he's 10 months younger than me, but he's always been bigger than me. And strict Pentecostal. My father was a musician in the church and superintendent of the Sunday school and all that kind of stuff. So, and we lived kind of like a really sheltered life. We were the only two African Americans at our school. We were on the really the good side of town in Sacramento. We were on the riverside, on the west side of town. And there were no African Americans there. Just my brother and I. And then till the age of 11, and my mother and father divorced. The Pentecostal church that I went to really didn't believe in sports. He was like crazy. He had some crazy athletes too. And we moved because my mother and father, when my mother and father were together, we lived good. My father drove nothing but Cadillacs. Mm-hmm. We lived in this early 60s, 61, 62, up in there, 63, 64. My father drove Cadillacs. We had a 3-bedroom, 2-story home. We had a swimming pool in our backyard. African Americans, not many live like that. Mm-hmm. And then my mother and father, 5 years after I was born, 4 after my brother, had twin sisters. And very quickly, they had 6 kids. And my mother and father broke up when I was 11. My father left, and I pretty much lost contact with him. He went into the gay life, and what happened. Mm-hmm. And here you have this 11-year-old kid who's now the head of the house. My mother had a third-grade education. She's a country girl, just worked on a farm. So I was signing checks. I was doing business and at 11. I was very bright. I was a 3.95 GPA, and I really didn't work hard for it. If I would have really applied myself, I could have done much better in school, but I did very well. Yeah. When they broke up, we moved from that side of town to the ghetto. Mm-hmm. I had never heard a curse word in my life. I had never had a real fight in my life. And immediately I was like thrown to the wolves. I remember my first day of school at the new school, I was more articulate than the rest. It was mainly African-American neighborhood. It's Oak Park, Sacramento. One of the roughest neighborhoods. Drug infested, prostitution. I seen it all. I seen killings. I saw people kill right in front of my face at 11. I was introduced to drugs. I was introduced to sex. I mean, I was having sex at 11, man. I was smoking cigarettes at 11. I stole my first car at 11. I smoked my first joint at 11. I didn't know what was going on. And I was raised in the church. And I was doing this to fit in because I'm from the other side. And I remember the first day of school in this new neighborhood, a guy called me a punk. I didn't know what a punk was. Everybody was laughing. I didn't know what a punk was, but I just knew I wasn't one. And so he called me a punk again, and he pushed me. And when he pushed me, I just let it loose because I could always fight. And I could always fight because I had a brother in my house who was bigger than me, and I wasn't afraid of anything big. So I knew I could handle it. So he got more than what he bargained for. Very soon, he developed a reputation for being able to whip bigger guys. And then my athletic career started. My brother and I's athletic career started when – I must have been in the fifth or sixth grade. There was a girl who my mother used to babysit from that neighborhood, who our house was on the way to the state capitol. She would drop her daughter off to our house for my mother to babysit her. So I knew her a year before we moved over there. And so one day I came out for recess, and her name was Lynn Lewis. This guy says, "Hey, Lynn Lewis is the fastest person in the school. She can beat even the boys. She's out there beating them." And when he said that, I'm coming out, I said, "I could beat Lynn Lewis." And they didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
And they had me run. I said, "I could beat her." He said, "You can't beat her." I said, "Watch." I go out and sure enough, Lynn has her shoes off and she's smoking the boys. I get down there and I smoke her. So now everybody's looking at me like,
Les Robinson's on the map right now.
And I said, "My brother can beat her too." And my brother gets down and he beats her. And then from that day on, I think we had street cred, because then the older boys started telling their brothers, "All right, so you need to teach those Robinson brothers how to play sports because they can run."
Mm.
And so we go on to be high school track and football stars. We're state meet participants and state meet champions, CIF champions. We won all Northern California football. We were, God bless us, but that's how we found, because my father, my father never pushed me towards sports. I never played Pop Warner. I never caught a ball from my father. He never took me running. And it was a gift from God.
And then, so from a young age up until and through high school, you had a great career into high school. You know, growing up back in the 60s, I mean, you were right in the middle of all the stuff that was happening, the social injustices that were taking place back then. So you saw firsthand, like you said, some of the stuff that was happening in our country back then, and then comparing it to what's kind of going on today. What are some of we know what the similarities are, right? But is there anything that's different that you saw back then as young age to what you're seeing the young people going through right now?
Well, it was kind of crazy for me because I was one of those kids, and you heard the stories about the Black Panthers. You would go pick up kids and feed them breakfast. I was one of those kids. They would come pick me and my brother up, and we'd have breakfast with them. They'd make breakfast for us and take us to school, and we'd be shouting "Free Huey" and all that kind of stuff. And we had the coloring books, and they had the pigs in them and all that kind of stuff. It was just like me and my brother were there in this late 60s, mid-60s, and we were unprotected. We didn't have any men in our life, no man, no father. It was like us in this jungle, and everybody was after us. The Black Muslims were after us. The Black Panthers were after us. The PAL Boxing League was after us. Everybody, you know, we were just like, everybody was. And I remember when the riots started in Sacramento, I was out. It was one Sunday afternoon. I was out in Oak Park playing basketball. Two guys had come home from church with us. It was a Sunday. And we were playing basketball out in the park. And all of a sudden, the police came through there in paddy wagons with helmets on. And they were shooting. And they were shooting at us. They were shooting at anything Black. We were running. I'm like, man, we were just trying to get away. I mean, we were hopping fences. We were just trying to get away. It was a mess. Mm-hmm. They burnt down that part of the city. I saw Molotov cocktails flying. I mean, I saw bullets. Several of my friends got shot. It was just crazy. It was crazy. But what I remember kind of being a turning point was when, like, the Selma situation, when whites began to embrace the movement and begin to look at Blacks as humans and begin to sympathize with us and begin to walk with us and march with us, and other nationalities begin to walk with us. It seemed like Dr. King was able to get some traction. Mm. Of course, he was murdered, and that kind of brought things to a halt for a number of years. But there are some definite similarities to then and now. The main thing being that African Americans in America have been what I call dehumanized by many people, and most people don't even know that we've been dehumanized. There are things that have been done to us and things that are said about us, and I just wish that people would befriend us and see us. And see that we're just like you. We have the same pains and hurts and fears and concerns and same crises. And
Yeah.
And the main thing we all have in common is that we were born in sin and shaped in iniquity. We have a sin problem, which causes us to act ugly and to hate one another.
Yeah. Yeah.
It shouldn't be. And we could fix this.
Yeah.
We absolutely really could fix this. And the answer is Jesus Christ. The answer is love.
Yes, sir.
It is love. Sir. It is truly love. Love is not a feeling. It is not an emotion, even though we have feelings. Even though we are emotional about love, love is a decision. Mm. God decided to send his son Jesus to die for us. He decided. There was no good reason why he should have done it. No sensible reason why he should have sent his son to die for us. But he did.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And because he did, and us who know the love of God, who have experienced the love of God and the forgiveness of God, we should be willing. I'm talking about black and white, to forgive and to love our fellow man, any man, any color, any size, any creed, because God is love. And I believe if we could understand the agape love of God, the unfailing, unending, unconditional love of God, and begin to apply that in our life, and understand that people are hurting everywhere and everyone needs love. There's no substitute for love because God is love. There's no resistance against love because God is love. And we all come from God and we're his sons and we're his daughters. If we could begin to look at each other that way, a lot of things that we're dealing with now would go away. The systematic racism in the financial realm, systematic racism in the educational realm, racism would disappear.
Yes, sir. No, absolutely. And Les, man, thank you for that. Just taking us back through that. I mean, you went through some pretty heavy stuff. So I appreciate you sharing your heart and some very intimate details of your childhood. And, you know, talking about sports, I mean, would you, if you get involved in track and football, Do you think that helped a lot steer you clear of maybe falling into a trap or falling into a way of life that would have taken you completely another way?
Oh, absolutely. I tell people today, I tell young parents, get your kids involved in sports. Get them involved. Sports saved my life. Football saved my life. Football made me see God. I knew who God was. I knew all about him, but it was a football coach who helped me see God. It was football that taught me how to persevere. It was football that taught me how to win. It was football that taught me how to lose. It was football that taught me how to recover. It was football that taught me how to love someone on my team who I didn't agree with and how to get along with them and make friends and keep friends and work on relationships and how to earn my keep and earn my position. It taught me how to work hard and to work hard even when I'm losing. It taught me how to be resilient. And so much. I love football as a coach, but the thing I love most about football, I think it is the most wonderful platform to teach life. Because you know, like I know, coach, football is life. I mean, you see every element, every phase of life in the sport of football. You learn how to win, you learn how to lose, you learn when to die, when to live, you learn how to do it. It just takes you through a range of emotions, and when you're in these emotional states, you have to learn how to handle them. After years and years of going to war, and football is war, it's the closest thing to war. Mm-hmm. We really learn what things are honorable, what things are worth fighting for, what things are worth dying for. You really learn about purpose and you learn how to care about people, even people who don't care about themselves. You learn how to teach them how to care about what's worth caring for.
Yes.
There are so many lessons. It's a hard sport. It's hard. But life is hard.
Right.
And so I just thank God. I really do. I love my job. I love coaching. I'm 63. I should be done. But I love coaching. I love what coaching does for men because it did it for me.
Yes, sir.
It saved my life. It saved my life. It opened my eyes. It opened the real eyes. It taught me about people, that there are good people and there are bad people. And it taught me how to navigate the sea of good people and bad people.
Right.
It's this wonderful, wonderful sport that is so hard, that teaches so many elements of life. I wouldn't trade it for nothing. I wouldn't.
No, sir. I 100% agree with you right there. When did you know that you wanted to coach? You played, and then once you were done, maybe playing after San Francisco State University.
San Francisco State to be a coach, and San Francisco State to learn under the great Vic Rowan.
Okay.
And he was an old coach when I got there. He was in his late 60s, and he's credited for teaching people like Mike Holmgren was on his staff. Was an assistant coach there. Some of the greats that we know served under Coach Vic Rowan. Andy Reid was on his staff. There's all kinds of great people, and I would see these great people come through. They either coached me or they would come through. I saw a lot of great NFL stars and coaches come through to learn from Coach Vic Rowan. And so I went there to learn.
Well, that's great. And so you graduated from San Francisco State, and then you had a few other what should we say, paths, I guess, before you got back into coaching. Is that right?
I tried to play some football, and I didn't make it, but I had great experiences. It was fun. The league was different then. You either made it or you didn't. There weren't that many opportunities, and you either fit their system or you didn't. And I was a Division III player, so I, had lots of speed and I was very strong and tenacious, but I just didn't fit some systems. And I came home and immediately got a job coaching.
Yeah.
Got a job coaching track. And I was a head track coach at a high school in Sacramento, Kennedy High School, and we won 8 straight titles. And
nice.
Coaching was easy for me. Even when I first started playing, my high school was a 3-year high school, and I knew every position. I knew what every player on the team was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And mind you, I didn't play offense until my senior year. Mm-hmm. I was a defensive back. And in my senior year, I just grew this wild hair, and I said, you know what? I'm going to see if I can stay on the field and not come off the field. And there were other backs that were supposed to beat me out. They had the position, and I didn't tell anyone I was going to go out. And I beat them out, and for the first month of the season, I led the nation rushing. I had 11.9 rushing average.
Yes, sir.
Back at it now, I'm like, my God. I think touchdown every 3 or 4 times I touch the ball.
That's not a bad ratio, Coach.
Oh, yeah. The first 3 times I touched the ball, I ran for a touchdown. The first one was 75 yards, the second one was 65, and the last one was 45. First 3 times. I had never played offense before.
Same game?
No, they were in different games.
You know, okay.
Like boom, boom.
There you go.
God just blessed me. But coaching came natural because I always had this, I wanted to know where everybody was.
Yeah.
You know, and I knew I just had this, God gave me this gift to see the whole picture. You know, I could see, like if he does this, he should do this and this is going to open up this. I no one explained it to me. I could just see it. You know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
I can't explain it, so I know it's God. No one taught me, so I know it's God. Even now, I can see the game. Like the people say, well, "Why don't you, stay up in the tower?" I said, "No, I don't want to stay." I said, "I need to be on the field." They say, "Why?" I said, "Because I can feel my enemy."
Yeah,
I can feel. I can feel their sideline. I can see their. I can feel their coach. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something about being a warrior. When you've been in battle. Mm-hmm. You can just smell blood. You can smell the different phases of the game. And so I like being on the field. I like, I just like that battlefield. It's just it's a high, I know this place. I'm comfortable here. Mm-hmm. I'm not a screamer. Mm-hmm. I like to be quiet. I actually don't hang around my team on the sideline. I kind of stay away from them. I try to stay 3 or 4 plays ahead. Like, what are they doing? What are You know, I don't know. I'm just
you're playing that chess match in your
yeah,
head.
It's just weird. Yeah. How can I get in their end zone? How can what are they going to do with us next? And God just blessed me with that. I don't know. I can't explain it. He just blessed me with. It's almost like a feel. You know, yeah. it's an anointing. It's a gift. I can't take credit for it. He's just been very good to me, and the jobs that I've gotten, they've been given to me.
Yeah.
I didn't. You know, I spent some time as an actor. I was an actor.
Mm-hmm.
That field just opened up to me. I did several movies and several TV shows and made lots of money and met lots of people. And it wasn't something I aimed to do. God just, he used that to get me to LA to do what I do now. I see that. I see that God used
acting. Isn't that interesting?
And get me. And I remember when all started happening.
Yeah.
I actually prayed. I said, God, you know I don't need this. I did. I actually said, God, you know, I don't. This is good. The great money, great, and it's fun. But you know, I don't need this. I said, and I remember before I got my SAG card, I went to do a movie and I was going to be an extra. And I prayed. I said, God, okay, God, you know, I don't need this, but if this is what you want me to do, let me get my SAG card today.
Mm.
And we were shooting a movie called American Me about the Mexican Mafia, Miami. And Edward James Olmos comes up to me and he selects me and he starts telling me about the movie. He said, hey, I want to give you a feature part. And I knew right there.
Man, oh man.
So here I am working with young men and young women all the way around circle from athletics to movies and TV, and all that other stuff just to get me to Southern California, to meet Coach Stevens. work with Coach Stevens and Coach Rick and people like that. And you know what? I am absolutely elated. I love what we do.
Yes,
I love the platform that God has given us to shape the future and to pour into the hearts and minds of young men and young women that we might produce a society for God. In these last and evil days, truly we need it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy
that
God shaped me the way he did.
Greatest experience on a TV or movie set?
Yeah.
What of your greatest highlights? What are your greatest highlights in that part of your life?
Oh my goodness. The greatest highlight would be I got to work alongside two actors that won Oscars, and they were just in their infancy. We worked on a movie called Congo.
Mm-hmm.
One was Laura Linney was one of the actors, and there's another gentleman his name doesn't come to mind right now. We were very close to one set, but I got to work with a lot of great actors that I saw. I got to work with John Travolta, Edward James Olmos, Al Pacino, Michelle Pfeiffer. I worked on Days of Our Lives. I worked with the Young Prince of Bel Air with Will Smith. I did Young and the Restless.
That's great.
Some great people, and it was a lot of fun. Ernie Hudson. Just some great people in the business. Charlie Sheen and Martin Sheen is the sweetest man in Hollywood. Great guy. Just, you know, experiences and stories I'll be able to tell my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren. just because of God, man. I mean, honestly, it's just like, I didn't do anything, Steve. I didn't do anything.
It's the right place at the right time, and the Lord bless it here.
Here I am to try to give what God has given me and help. I just want to love people and spread love and, you know, in our current situation now, racial reconciliation and things like that, I just want to try to help all of us find our way to love.
Yes, sir.
I don't know what part I can play, but I know I can love, and I know I can demonstrate love and promote love, you know.
You do it well, Coach. You do it well. From the moment I met you, you exuded that. And, I know that that's your heart, and you can say it all you want, but I tell you, even if you didn't say that, Les, people that know you know exactly that is your heart, because it just comes right out of you. It just shines right out of you. And I so much appreciate that. And more people need that. More people need to be around people like you that just exude that kind of love and that presence and just that compassionate heart and spirit. And we know life has taught you that. And we know you've mm-hmm. gone through, you had to go through some things to get to this point where it's all we know. It's all we can do is love people. And, in reflecting back on some things, again, things that we're waking up in America, and finally, having some things brought to light. You just recently had something brought to light about your family. So let's take us back to your great, great grandpa. Tell us a little bit about this, this legacy in the Robinson family.
Yes. I come to find out where this loving spirit came from and this giving spirit came from. Year before last, I was 62 old. I found out I was having a barbecue with my brother and some cousins from my father's side. My father left, like I said, when I was 11, so I didn't get to meet that side of the family. And his mother actually lived to be 105. I knew her. My grandmother lived to be 105.
Okay.
She died 3 years ago. Oh. And so it was my father's stepbrother's daughters were at the barbecue, and I was telling them that I knew my family's history all the way back to the slave ship on my mother's side. Mm. I did. Part of me is German. You see my jawline, I'm German.
Okay.
Part of me was German. And she said, well, I said, but I don't know anything about my father's side. Mm. She said, well, have you ever heard of Daniel Blue? Mm. I said, no. She said, well, why don't you Google Daniel Blue? So I Googled Daniel Blue right there at the table, and I began to read. She said, Google Daniel Blue of Sacramento. And I Googled Daniel Blue of Sacramento, and I began to read about this man named Daniel Blue, and came to find out he's my great-great-grandfather. Who Daniel Blue was he was a former slave in Kentucky who somehow got out to California, came out to California in 1849 during the gold rush, and discovered some gold and bought about 7 blocks of downtown Sacramento, I Street, basically, from 7th all the way to the river. And on I Street now is the federal courthouse, the county jail, the county courthouse, and the Southern Pacific Railway Station, as well as the Southern Pacific Railway Museum, which was actually his front porch.
Man.
And yes, after he came to Sacramento in 1849, he established the oldest AME church in his home in 1850. Now, Daniel Blue, being a slave, an ex-slave, went about the business of freeing slaves. So people were coming to California who brought slaves in, and Daniel Blue would, through the ministry of his church and his elders and whites that came to his church, they were free slaves. Mm. And so because of this, he was under attack all the time. He later moved the church out of his house in somewhere around 1860, and they burnt the church down. Mm. He rebuilt the church, and in 1863, they burned it down again. And then there was a church split. And then he continued on with his church, and in somewhere around 1865, they tried to burn him and his children out of their house. They did. Mm. And they were trying to kill him. When you read his epitaph, when you read the story of his life, you'll see he just continually loved people. He was known for loving people and caring about people and giving to people. And they said that the whole city of Sacramento knew who Dan, when he died, everyone knew. You could not say you lived in Sacramento and did not know Daniel Blue. St. Andrew's AME Church is one of the oldest churches, like I said, west of the Mississippi. Mm. On his grave site, there is a state plaque commemorating him. On his downtown, on the courthouse, there's a plaque commemorating his ownership and started a church on that property. And my deal was, and where his church is now is on U Street in Sacramento. I managed a swimming pool in the park there for 6 years, and I never knew that was my grandfather.
That's mind-blowing.
Oh, I never knew who he was. I never heard his name. And I was wondering, how in the world did we hide him from history? Mm. There are articles about him in the New York Times. I have all kinds of articles and news clippings about work he did and things about the church and him being in Sacramento. And why wasn't it in the history books? Mm. I mean, I grew up in Sacramento. I know, I was going by his house, his church, his... I even caught the train.
Right outside his front porch used to be.
I've been to the museum when it first opened and had no idea. They said that was his front porch.
Right. Right.
But there are countless African-American stories and history that's been hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. He had a legacy of love, and he loved people. And so, I have been praying to God. I said, God, I want to leave something in the earth. I want to leave a legacy.
Yeah,
I've been praying for that for years.
Mm-hmm.
And when I discovered him, God told me, he said, you've been living a legacy. You just didn't know it.
Mm.
You just need to finish it.
Beautiful.
You've been living a legacy all along. And so I want to continue my great-great-grandfather's legacy. I want to continue the legacy of Christ and love people, even the unlovable, because my great-great-grandmother raised my father.
Mm-hmm.
And so when my father got married to my mother, he brought her into our house. And so she lived in the one bedroom that we had upstairs. Her bedroom was upstairs. And she actually died in her bedroom. She died of cancer.
Mm.
And I was about 5 years old. I remember that. And that's how I knew that the article was, I saw her name. Her name was Hazel White. And then her daughter's name was Lola Reed, who's my grandmother. So okay. I'm reading this article on Daniel Blue, and I'm reading my grandmother's name and my great-great-grandmother's name. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is my great-great-grandfather. I know these people. I know she lived with me. She died in my room.
Oh, my goodness.
At 62, I found all this out. So
amazing.
When things straighten up, I'm going to go back to Kentucky. I'm going to try to find, more about him. I have some friends on the Sacramento Historical Society who are doing research for me, and I'm going to try to put together a book.
Mm.
Hopefully it will. I have a movie producer who's interested in the story, would like to tell the story or just shown interest. That would be a wonderful thing.
Outstanding, Coach. I hope that comes to fruition. I really do. And for those of you that are listening, it's the last name is just Blue, the color Blue, Blue. Mm-hmm. Is that how you spell it?
Yeah. Yes. Daniel Blue, Blue.
Yeah, look, boy, Google him and look him up, and there's a story to be told there. And I hope that in the future generation, my kids who are going to be going into high school in just a few short years, as the new textbooks are coming out and as everything's changing, everything's, coming to light, hopefully they can read it. And if they don't, I will make sure they learn about Daniel Blue, my brother's great-great-grandfather. That would definitely be part of that. But we're just hoping that story gets told less. And man, that movie would be that'd be something. That'd be something special.
Great. So,
yes, sir. Well, as we kind of wrap up our time here, Coach, there's a big announcement coming up. Going back kind of to the world of football. CIF Southern Section, CIF State is going to make an announcement here next Monday on July 20 about football, and if we're going to have a season in the fall, or if we're going to have a season in the spring, or if we're going to have a season. Just real quick, what are some of your thoughts and some of the things that you've been looking at and seeing, whether it be social media or people you've talked to, other coaches, anything about this upcoming announcement? What do you think is going to be their decision? And when it actually, and when this airs, when our episode airs here, this will be a couple of weeks down the road. So actually we'll see how this goes. But what do you think? What do you think is going to happen here in the next few days?
Well, in the beginning of the COVID-19 situation, when we were doing well in California, when we were being obedient,
yeah.
and the numbers
were low. Put that, yeah.
Yeah, and the numbers were low before the holidays started and before everyone got spring fever and got careless.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like we were going to play a regular season. I figured, hey, we'll get a hold of this and we'll get on it. But then in the last 2 weeks, when the numbers began to surge and soar to outrageous numbers, mm-hmm. With each week, I began to say to myself, I don't see how they're going to let us play this fall.
Yeah.
Because we've digressed in terms of our commitment to control the virus. It's run rampant and it's everywhere, mm-hmm. and it's surging in California. So I really don't see how our public officials could let us play and sleep at night.
Mm.
So my feeling now is that we'll probably be playing in January, mm-hmm. or sometime thereafter. I don't think we'll be playing in the fall.
Lord willing, we get a season in the spring. I agree, Coach. I think with the new with that announcement from the LA Unified School District, and very soon, I'm working in the Chino Valley Unified, but I'm coaching in the Chaffee Joint Unified. I got a foot in both camps now. I think San Bernardino County as a whole, though, I think will probably follow suit. And like you said, I agree. I think it'd be hard pressed for the CIF state officials and the powers that be say, let's go ahead and have a season when kids are distance learning. And I think to be on the same page and to continue to do what's right by families, by kids, by Amen. Teachers, yes, all of us, right? To kind of take that and put that on a pause. So let's assume, and like I said, this episode will air after the decision, but let's just say we're on the same page, not going to do it in the spring. How do you, as a head football coach in your program now, looking at fall without football, what are some techniques, what are some suggestions, or what are some things that you think you might do, not just with distancing learning, obviously, that's going to be part of it. Your school is going to go back to traditional, right? We talked about that briefly. So Trinity Classical Academy, for those of you who don't know, is far and away full traditional. So you will have your boys. You will have your boys on campus. But without games, right, without the actual season in the fall, then what do you think you might do to kind of just keep going, you know, besides the workouts and all that stuff that could get long and tedious? What are some things that you're thinking you might do with the boys come fall without the games on Friday night?
Well, I've already figured out that my August will become my normal May.
Okay.
So what I did in May I'll be doing in August. And we got some young guys that we have to get schooled up. And so we'll use, if January becomes play day, we'll use August, and September will become May and June.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll recover that time that we lost because of COVID and continue to work. And we do things at Trinity. We take trips. We normally go see USC play, UCLA. Mm-hmm. We'll take a train trip. We normally take a train trip out to Philippe's. You know, Philippe's, the restaurant, the historical restaurant downtown.
Mm,
we'll take a train trip to the old Central Station and walk a couple blocks and go to Philippe's and have breakfast together and then come through. And then we'll go places. We take trips out to, like, we'll take the team and we'll all go on a Saturday morning and go to Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles.
We do
stuff like that. Well, we just get close, we eat, and you know, and get to know each other, and give the kids nicknames and know, stuff like that to build team unity and brotherhood. Because you know, Friday night's a fight, and you need your brothers. And so, in order to win and be successful, you have to become brothers. So we try to give them experiences and make. Put them in scenarios where they get to know each other and fall in love with each other and learn to respect each other. And we like to challenge them, man, to be men. And it's tough for these young men. You remember what it was like, you know?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Those tough days, but they bring you so close, and you never forget those memories. You learn so much, and you grow so much, and it's just every year you see a freshman come in, and then you see him leave 4 years later, and he's totally different. Totally different.
Yes, sir.
And it's so rewarding to see him come in. They can barely run, and they don't know what's going on. And when you and when they leave, they're not only men, but they're gentlemen. They know how to speak. Yep. They know how to act.
Yeah.
They make you proud. I mean, you know.
Yes, sir.
You know, to, you know, this guy's going to go do something great. And we got to be a little part of this story.
Yeah.
It's so fulfilling and so rewarding. Yes, somebody sir. Did it for me. Mm. They honestly did. They saw this kid. Mm. These are tears of joy. They
yes,
saw
sir.
This kid who had yes, no sir. Direction. We had no idea what he had. When I started playing football, I just wanted to be on the team. I just wanted to, you know, I had no idea that it would take me this far. I had no idea that I would be doing what I'm doing. I just wanted to be with the guys. I wanted to try to make the team.
Yeah.
And it's carried me so far.
Yes, sir.
It's given me so many memories and allowed me to go so many places and meet so many people. I wouldn't replace it for nothing. Not one moment. I'd do it over again 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 times. It's been wonderful. It's a wonderful sure. game. Some wonderful people in it. Not everything about it is wonderful, but that's life.
Yes, sir.
You learn and you grow. You either get better or you get bitter.
Yeah.
All up to you. But I wouldn't trade. Not one moment. And it brought me to a relationship with Jesus Christ. I'm not perfect. But I'm working on me, and he'll do the rest.
Yes, sir.
You know?
Yes, sir. Absolutely, Les. Oh, man, thank you for your heart, brother. I really do. And I know that coaches are listening, and coaches' wives may be listening. Players may be listening to this, and they can feel you. You know, they hear your heart. And they resound with you. I resound with you, and there are hundreds and thousands of people out there that are resounding with you that we need football. We need this. And there are articles written, and there are things, and there's stats and all this stuff. But what you just gave right there in that little short time is exactly you are personifying why we need the game and what it did for you. And so many boys that are coming up under your leadership and your guidance need the game. They need you. They need a man like you in their lives to do exactly what that coach did for you to do for them, and so on and so forth. And we just keep paying it forward. The legacy and that's coming up behind you, not just football. Right? We talk about FCA. We talk about the 8,000 plus kids who know Jesus, who have a secure place in heaven today because of your leadership. And now all those kids in football, you know, we need that. We need the game, and we need to continue to play. So we're hoping, right, that if we're on pause for a moment in the fall, that they will see the need for sports in general, but football specifically, that we can still play this game in 2021 and keep impacting those kids, Les, and do what you do best, man. Well, Les, we're going to wrap up on time. I want to thank you again so much for your time, for your heart. This has been a blessing, and when this comes out, coaches all over the place, and people are going to just glean from this for so many different reasons. And I thank you again for sharing your heart and just being a part of my life and my friend and my brother. And man, Godspeed to you and God's blessings. And we'll continue to pray for FCA. We'll continue to pray for Trinity Classical Academy and the time to come.
Thank you, Coach Stevens. Love you, man.
Love you too, brother.
Still don't think football can save lives? I bet Coach Les Robinson could argue that point. What a great testimony. Thank you to Coach for coming on the show and telling us his true testimony of growing up on the streets and how football and athletics in general turned his life around for the better and how it could have been a whole lot worse. I want to thank you, Coach, for coming on and sharing your story about your legacy, your family, about your great-great-grandpa, Daniel Blue. And we look forward to the football season coming up. It's not going to be in the fall. It's going to be in the spring this year, folks. So stay tuned for that. If you liked what you heard today, we thank you for joining us, first of all. And if you liked it, please subscribe to our podcast. Leave us some comments, some reviews. Tell us some things that you'd like to hear going forward. We're going to have a lot to talk about in the upcoming episodes, so we'd love to hear your thoughts. And we want to thank you again for joining us on the Friday Night Life. And we want to thank Coach Les Robinson one more time. Appreciate you, Coach. All the best. And we appreciate you, too. Thanks for tuning in.